Scout CEO Aidan Cahill joins us for a special interview on cyber threats to MSPs, news from the Acronis Global Cyber Summit, Toma Bravo makes a bid on Sophos, AI is coming to view images in your emails, ASCII's 35-year balancing act, and more. It's Channel Pro Weekly, episode 121, Unveiled. Welcome to Channel Pro Weekly, episode 121. My name is Matt Whitlock, Technology Editor, Online Director, and you are host of this fine audio program and video program, too, because if you're watching on YouTube, you can see my face. So, and if you didn't know, if you're subscribed on audio, that's great. We love you having on audio. If you want to see us, you can find Channel Pro Weekly on YouTube as well, and hopefully other places in the future. But Rich... I'm going to introduce Rich, and then Rich is going to tell you who you are in case you're having an identity crisis to help you out a little bit. So joining me this week and pretty much every week is my partner in crime, co-host, executive editor, snazzy black t-shirt wearer, Rich Freeman.
And greetings, everybody. Great to be here back on the show, back home in Seattle. If you are wondering who you are, if you look in the mirror and you're thinking, who the heck am I listening to this podcast or watching it? You are a managed service provider. You are a value-added reseller. You may describe yourself as a solution provider or an integrator. You may sell managed print. Audio-visual, you may be a system builder. If you are serving the technology needs of small and mid-sized businesses, by golly, you found the right place to be.
And you know what? I will say this. If right now you are a person that works at Great Clips but aspires to be one of those things that you just said rather than cutting people's hair, you are also in the right place.
Absolutely. This is the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Listening to this podcast could be your first step to a fabulous wealth in the world of SMB technology.
Changing lives, one show at a time. All right. Well, now that we got that out of the way, Rich, so you're back in Seattle, but you actually just got back from somewhere, right?
I was in Miami first 3 days of the week for the Acronis conference we'll be talking about in a minute. And so it was like 85 plus degrees and sunny and gorgeous and wonderful in Miami. And it's like 50 and dark and pouring rain here in Seattle right now. I do love my hometown, but I got to say, Miami was nice.
Miami is nice this time of year. June and July, it is pretty darn hot, I have to say, and very humid. And they have mosquitoes there the size of grapefruits.
Yeah, we weren't dealing with much of that this week.
That's good. So we do have a lot to talk about this week, including Acronis, since I know we got some stories there. For those who are also interested in what's going on, we've got some interesting news about Sophos, Vade Secure, Supermicro. We're going to be talking a little bit about ASCII and NIST for IoT. And also we have a great interview that we recorded in advance that we're going to put in this show here with Aidan Cahill from Scout. Who, for those who don't know Scout, they are the cybersecurity company. And we're going to talk about cybersecurity and specifically security threats to MSPs. Very interesting interview, wasn't it, Rich?
Absolutely, yep.
And even if it wasn't, Rich would tell you that it was.
That's timely stuff, too. So, yeah, very interesting.
It is. Yeah, and actually, it's a really great interview. I hope you all stick around and listen to and or watch that coming up. So without further ado, I know we got a lot crammed into the show, so we're just going to get started. Now, Rich, you were just at Acronis, their event that you said in Miami, and they unveiled? I guess unveiled would be... unveiled would be like taking away the calf meat.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. But they do that in Miami too, just so you know. Cyber protection portfolio for edge and endpoint. Rich, tell us about what's going on there.
So, Acronis has come up on the podcast. It's popped up on our homepage, channelpronetwork.com, a bunch of times this year, really for the last 6+ months. They have been telling folks that they're hosting this event in October. It's the first global cyber summit that they've ever done before. So they've been telling everybody, we've got an event coming up in October. We are going to use it as the launching pad, basically, for a whole new cybersecurity addition to our portfolio. So Acronis is a very familiar name in the channel. They and actually in the consumer world, they are mostly known as a backup company right now. They do some other things. But the first thing that comes to mind when most people hear the name Acronis is backup. What they are doing or have done now at this point is redefine themselves as a cyber protection company, which is basically backup data protection, as it's traditionally thought of, plus security in one bundle. And so we knew that they had a product suite coming originally on, or for many months, actually, they've been referring to that product as under the name Total Protect. Apparently that name went away because they unveiled the new solution at the conference this week, and it's called Cyber Protect instead of Total Protect now. And it is actually one component of a larger family of products that all fit together very neatly. So Cyber Protect, Acronis Cyber Protect, is a multi-layered, multifaceted endpoint and edge security solution. So it includes antivirus, but also things like intrusion detection. There are a whole bunch of different security safeguards that are quite often sold separately. They're all kind of bundled together into this one package. You run Cyber Protect on and with a separate solution called Acronis Cyber Infrastructure. And you can kind of think of this as the infrastructure or appliance equivalent of a BDR appliance, right? We're very familiar from the business continuity disaster recovery world with products from companies like Datto, appliances that sit on site with the customer, and you can use those to spin up a virtual environment when you need to and store backups and stuff like that. So Acronis has built a purpose-built infrastructure solution, a hyper-converged infrastructure solution complete with software-defined networking and storage that goes along with Cyber Protect and is the infrastructure piece of that. And it's a little bit different from those more traditional BDR appliances in that it incorporates this security functionality as well. And then the third piece of this big picture is the Acronis Cyber Platform, which is the platform underlying both the infrastructure and Cyber Protect. So it's the code base, the collection of technologies that make the whole thing work. But it also comes with a pretty extensive set of APIs backed with SDKs and all sorts of developer resources. And Acronis really wants their cyber protection solutions to be a platform for other companies, third parties, to integrate with. And if you use these tools that they've provided to connect with the cyber platform, your third-party solution can actually be a seamlessly integrated piece of the Acronis solution in terms of how users view your data, manage your systems, and so on. It's all through the same pane of glass, if you will. So I'm skipping ahead here just a little bit into the second item on our show sheet here, Matt. But it's really this is not the end. It's not like the culmination of a process for Acronis, but it's a very important milestone and one that has been going on for longer than I realized, essentially. So Sergey Belousov, I hope I'm saying his name right, Sergey Belousov, I believe, he's the founder of Acronis, but he was not originally the CEO. He and the other investors who created this company hired somebody to run the business. But they decided towards the end of 2013 that this guy wasn't getting the job done. They needed a new CEO, and it needed to be one of them, one of the investors behind the company. In essence, Sergey kind of drew the short straw, as I understand it. Everybody else had other things going on, but because he lives closest to the company, he agreed he would do it. And within a matter of months, so by early 2014, he already knew where he wanted to take the company, which was beyond backup into cyber protection, security plus backup. But they had five different code bases that had to be pulled together, and then there was a lot of functionality that had to be added to all that. And it's taken them 5 years. The whole vision won't really be rolled out until early 2020, so it's really more like 6 years to pull that all off. But they've been working at it very hard for a very long time, and I think that's one reason why this offering that they unveiled in Miami this week is as complete, as wide ranging, as kind of mature, if that's the right word, as it is for something that is at a 1.0 kind of level. It was striking to me how much it does, how many different pieces there are of it. It typically takes a vendor a lot longer than that to get to this state.
Well, it's a different approach, right? And that's kind of interesting that they mention or talk about why they went that way rather than, say, the more iterative approach that, frankly, most software-based companies kind of have these days, where they release a product and, you know, it may not have everything. It might just be very basic, but then they just kind of keep iterating it while it's in use, rather than take 6 years to develop and put out a more hopefully complete product.
You know, I did get an opportunity to interview Sergey. We didn't get into that particular topic, so I'm kind of trying to read his mind a little bit, which by the way is a dangerous thing to do. He is a brilliant guy. He's got like 200 plus patents under his name. You wouldn't even believe what he's done and is doing at any given time. But based on that conversation, I think he has very strong feelings about what it is to deliver a cyber protection solution, period. Like, you know, a solution that is missing this piece or that piece isn't a solution at all. So I would guess that he sort of felt, you know, all of this stuff was necessary to get to that 1.0 stage.
So So there are other cyber protection solutions out there. How do you think, or how does he think, or how do you think this one stacks up to some of the other ones?
Very, very interesting question. And it kind of gets to, so this is good. We've kind of advanced onto the third item on the show sheet there a little bit, because I did talk to him about, and not so much about other cyber protection, you know, to use their terminology, cyber protection platforms, because right now there really aren't a lot of, now I believe, just dropping some hints here, I don't know this for a fact, but I believe Carbonite, which bought Webroot earlier this year and is headed very much down that same road, I think by this time next month, they're going to have announced some things that we will be able to compare to this Acronis solution. There isn't a whole lot to compare the Acronis solution to right now. Except, you know, the obvious thing to compare this to is some of these big managed services suites out there, right? You know, which, and SolarWinds comes to mind, but, you know, you could think of Datto and Kaseya and so on, that have BDR components, that have security components, maybe not, you know, as complete, as sort of end-to-end in terms of the functionality, but you as an MSP now are faced with this choice where I'm a Datto guy and I use their RMM and their PSA and I love their BDR products. And I, you know, I can also, when they get in, they're not into security now, but when and if they add security, I can get my cybersecurity from Datto as well. And it's one-stop shopping and I like the guys at Datto, or I can entrust my cyber protection responsibilities to Acronis. And so I did kind of get in, you know, during the interview with Sergey, I mean, why do you think somebody would go with you as opposed to just the convenience of getting everything from one supplier? And I mean, his answer basically was there's plenty of business out there for everybody. There are, you know, billions of work. So some people will, you know, maybe go with the one supplier strategy. Others maybe will like the looks of our technology and its capabilities and go with us. But I think that question of is a distinct, a separate set of technologies for BDR and security that are not woven together with some of these other things like RMM and PSA and so on, is that going to be a you know, an attractive or a compelling product for MSPs?
And I think it would be, right? We're seeing a lot of consolidation around RMM and ERP systems with all of these other technology solutions that integrators are and MSPs are selling. So do you think that maybe at some point Acronis is going to say, well, we, in order to compete, we're going to need to build compatibility and hooks into these different RMM platforms so that way we can kind of be a part of that whole solution, but still be a separate vendor without like offering our own whole huge RMM ERP suite.
Well, I should be clear. They already have integration with, you know, there were a bunch of folks from ConnectWise, for example, at the show. ConnectWise has been a great Acronis partner and vice versa for a bunch of years. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, integration with RMM tools, PSA tools, et cetera, from other companies are very much part of the solution and the strategy for the solution. For example, the people at Kaseya would tell you that it's important and it's good, and we wholeheartedly embrace integration with third-party solutions. But there's integration and there's integration. There's a level of integration you can achieve when you own the products yourself and the code base, and you're totally in control of every aspect of what all those tools do. So yes, Acronis integrates with these managed services suites. Whether or not that integration is as tight, as deep as you might be able to get from the suite manufacturers is an open question.
Right, and then that's up to the RMM ERP platform to say, well, how deep do we want to allow you to integrate? And probably in order to keep their competitive edge, I would imagine. We are bouncing around a little bit here, so let's talk about the keys to the cyber protection strategy.
The differentiators, let's say, for the strategy. So as I was interviewing Sergey, I kind of highlighted the completeness of the solution and the integration, the tight integration of its pieces. And somewhat gently corrected me. From his perspective, the things to emphasize aren't that it's complete or that it's integrated. The three things that he feels really strongly are absolutely essential in a security solution, specifically for edge and endpoint workloads. It's simple, it's reliable, and it's affordable. And the thinking basically is there's a lot of complexity involved in protecting edge and endpoint workloads. And if you expose the user to any of that complexity, it makes it less likely that they will use this technology they need to keep themselves safe. So you need something that from an end user perspective or even an MSP perspective is easy, so that to encourage people to actually use the system and take advantage of its capabilities. The reliability piece is fairly straightforward, right? I mean, it really can't fail. Or else you're not protecting data, you're not warding off security threats and so on. And then there's the affordability piece of that, which maybe isn't the most important of the three. But again, if top quality functionality comes at a price tag that drives SMBs out of the market, then nobody's going to be capitalizing on what you've built. So those were the keys to the strategy that Acronis was emphasizing: simplicity, reliability, and affordability.
Yeah, and so do you think, kind of rounding it out, you've made some mental notes? Do you want to talk about any of those about just their Cyber Summit in general, their strategy, their direction?
So I'll just toss something in there. So there were, three articles that I posted out of this conference, and one of them just announced the new products. The other kind of got into some of that simplicity, reliability, affordability stuff we were just talking about. The last one has some smaller notes about, where Acronis is headed and so on. I'll just call attention to one of those six notes just because it's kind of interesting. So, MSPs, the MSP channel is a relatively new priority for Acronis. They've been recruiting MSPs into their partner program for about 4 years at this point. So 4 years ago, they had no MSP partners. As of today, they have about 5,800. And the goal is to get to 25 to 50,000 within the next few years. I want to say it was 3 years from now. They think they can have 25 to 50,000 partners. So very ambitious goals in terms of partner recruitment. So if you are an MSP listening to this podcast, you haven't heard from Acronis yet, my guess is you will be hearing from them soon, because that's a big number, and it's going to take a lot of a lot of marketing, a lot of effort on their part to hit that target.
Yeah, you know, I also saw in your notes that they're doing a cyber marketplace. Can you just give a quick little note about that? Because I'm seeing a lot of marketplaces pop up. I want to see what theirs is all about.
Yeah, I am too, actually, and it is sort of interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, you know, the most obvious application or examples of application marketplaces that everyone is familiar with is, you know, AWS has one, Microsoft has one, in the managed services world, ConnectWise has one. I have spoken with the folks at Sophos, who we'll be talking about again, and they definitely have aspirations to turn their Sophos Central management tool, which is like the hub that connects all of our different solutions. They would love for that to be a marketplace where other companies can add their products, sell their products to people and add them to that management plane as well. This is very much something that Acronis wants to do. It's part of that strategy for the Acronis cyber platform and the APIs and software development tools and so on. Is, you know, to ultimately have this kind of marketplace of solutions where an Acronis partner or customer can go and add new capabilities into the existing software that they're running.
Very cool. I have two more questions that I want to ask. One, I want to go back to the cyber protection portfolio in general. Mm. And I know there's like three parts to it. There's the infrastructure, there's the protect layer, and then there was the what was the third one?
The platform.
The cyber platform. Now, are those mutually exclusive? Like, can you use any one part of those? Or are those like really the three pieces that make the solution and you're not going to use, you can't use cyber protect, for example, without the infrastructure, without the platform?
So the platform underlies both the infrastructure and protect. So if you use either of those, you know, you're using the platform. I'm a little bit unclear on whether or not you have the option of using protect without the infrastructure. My impression is no, because it's, again, it's not a complete solution unless you have both of those components, and they are, excuse me, they're designed very much to work together. So I don't know that you have the option of, you know, getting an appliance from some other vendor and kind of hooking that up to cyber protect. There is flexibility built into the solution, by the way, in terms of where you run the infrastructure, where you store the data. Acronis has its own cloud. You can use that. You can use AWS or Azure. You can use a private cloud on site. I keep talking about an appliance, and it is an appliance, but you can get it either in a physical format from Acronis or in a virtual format and run it on your own, you know, server hardware. So there is flexibility built into the solution, but I'm pretty sure all these things have to kind of be used together.
Okay, cool. Now, and the last question that I have is something that you brought up that I found very interesting and I've never really heard before. You said that they were trying to find a new CEO, and he drew the short straw.
Yep.
So, okay. Now, when I think of CEO, right, I think of like money, power, money, more money, more money. Yes, a lot of work. But is that really drawing a short straw?
Well, and I don't really know very much about the other investors, the other people who kind of came together to create Acronis. But I mean, I know a little bit about Sergey, and money wasn't an issue for him in 2013 because he, you know, among other things, among many other things, he founded Parallels and sold Parallels. So, I mean, he was already a very wealthy guy by 2013, didn't really have to worry about money. And he's just, you know, this very restless, very creative thinker. He's got his finger in a lot of different pies. He's got all these things going on. And so he wasn't looking for a CEO gig. He had other stuff going on. And this was obviously going to be a huge time commitment. So yeah, for him, and this was true apparently of all the other investors behind the company, nobody really wanted to make the time to do this. They just knew this business is a great thing. We don't want it to fail because, you know, none of us was willing to step in. And geez, you've got the shortest commute, Sergey. You know, you win. You're the CEO.
Yeah, I never heard of anybody saying like, I got this amazing top level position. because by drawing a short straw. Like, to me, like, yeah, he just won the lottery, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Cronus, if you want a new CEO, I can learn and I will gladly take the position if it comes with a high paycheck.
Don't do it. Don't do it, Acronis, because then I've got to find another co-host. On screen, so
always holding me back, Rich. Yeah, how dare you?
I know. I'm so selfish.
Oh, that's awesome. Good. Hey, if you have any comments, questions, anything you want to tell us about Acronis and what they talked about and their show, or any questions about it, podcast@channelportnetwork.com is the email address. Send it to us or go to the comment section on YouTube. Or hit us on social media. We'll give you all those at the end of the show. And yeah, and do that. So, and also we put the links to all of the stories that we talk about in our show notes sheet on the channelportnetwork.com website, if you're listening. So you can go to channelportnetwork.com, go to the downloads area and find the show sheet for this episode, episode 121. Click on that, and then you'll see a list of all of the links. Click on those, and you can kind of follow along the stories as we talk about them to get all the detail, because we don't go totally in-depth here in the show. And if you're watching on YouTube, if you hit the description button at the top, the See More description, we'll put all the links in there as well, so you can also see all the stories and kind of read along and while we talk about these things. Rich, did you know that you could do that?
Who knew?
Who knew? You knew. I knew. Now they know. Tell your friends. All right. Up next, we're talking a lot about, we've talked more about private equity investment.
Yeah.
In the last 2 years than I think we've talked about in the last 10.
It is crazy. Yeah. And I keep thinking about that. I need to carve out some time to really bone up on private equity. I mean, I know a little bit about it, but I really feel like I need to know a lot more about it, because it is playing such an outsized role in our industry right now. And I, you know, it's really only just kind of beginning, and this next story kind of illustrates that.
It does. Another one bites the private equity dust, Rich. And Thoma Bravo is looking to buy Sophos.
Yeah. And I mean, this is big, right? I mean, right now there are three big private equity names that own large hunks of the managed services world, the SMB channel vendor world. So there's Vista Equity Partners, which owns Datto. There's Insight Venture Partners, which owns Kaseya. And then there's Thoma Bravo. And Thoma Bravo has a really interesting and you know, rapidly expanding portfolio of companies that are relevant to our listeners here. Those are the guys, the private equity guys, who bought ConnectWise earlier in the year. They bought Continuum about 2.5 years ago. They also own Barracuda, and now they own a piece of. They used to own SolarWinds outright. SolarWinds is now publicly traded, but Thoma Bravo still owns a piece of SolarWinds, and now Thoma Bravo would like to own Sophos, the security vendor, obviously. Now this is a little bit different, you know, in the case of most of those other companies that I mentioned there. Acquiring the company was a private transaction, essentially. Sophos is a publicly traded, it's a UK-based company, publicly traded on the London Stock Exchange. So all of this right now is contingent upon shareholders, accepting the offer from Thoma Bravo. They offered $7.40 US a share, which values the company at about $3.9 billion. This is a pretty big acquisition.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yeah. And just to put it in context, I mean, the ConnectWise acquisition was a huge deal, obviously, in Channel Pro land. And nobody knows exactly what the price tag was for that, but the educated conjecture, basically, is about $1.5 billion. And this is, you know, 3.9. So kind of a big deal. The board is, you know, the board of Sophos approves of this offer. They think it's a fair offer. They have indicated that they are going to recommend that shareholders accept the offer. I have no idea what the timing is on when a vote takes place and this all becomes kind of official. But it looks like it's probably going to happen. Unless I'll just put this out there. There's no reason to think this is going to happen, but I keep wondering, is there any possibility of essentially a hostile bid coming into the picture? It's like $7.40 a share has been offered. Could there be somebody out there right now who's thinking, geez, if I offer $7.75, I could take Sophos, and is it worth that? And I don't know. That would be fascinating if this turned into a bidding war. But for right now, looks like Thoma Bravo is going to add Sophos to its portfolio. And it will be very interesting. I mean, Sophos has three things that I would think are pretty appealing to a private equity investor. So they play in the security market, which is huge and growing huger all the time. They have very good, respected technology. I don't know how Sophos tools kind of stack up in these neutral tests that are done with security software. But, it's a wide-ranging portfolio. It's very integrated, closely integrated. So it's good technology from a security standpoint. And they have an MSP partner base and an MSP partner program. And that, to me, that feels like the sort of latent bit of value in Sophos that may very well factor into Thoma Bravo's thinking here. That, at a minimum, we get this great company, great security play at a time when the security market is great. But, Thoma Bravo obviously knows its way around the managed services space right now. And they may feel like we could take that MSP program Sophos has right now, which is sort of a piece of the puzzle there, and turn it into something much bigger and turn Sophos into more of a managed services oriented security play that would kind of dovetail with the rest of our MSP strategy. I don't know, but that'll be one of the to me, the most interesting things to watch is what, if anything, does Thoma Bravo do to influence the MSP part of the picture at Sophos?
Yeah. That is going to be interesting. I'm just stuck on the amount of money. 3.9 billion dollars. All right. So I'm going to ask the obvious question. Why does Thoma Bravo want Sophos?
Well, for the three reasons, I don't know. I can't come up with a better reason than those three. Security is a huge market. These guys have a well-known and respected tool set in security that covers a lot of bases: mobile security, email security. They do firewalls. They have antivirus, et cetera. And maybe, I don't know, in my mind, the intriguing third X factor there might be that they also have an MSP play. But, if you're looking to make a big splash in security, Sophos actually is a pretty good target.
It is a good target, but it's a very large and expensive target, right? Normally when I see these private investment firms, they're usually going after some of the more up and coming, smaller, significantly less expensive, but with a really good future. Sophos is established. It's there. It's done. Is it going to dramatically grow more than it is right now?
Only time will tell there. I think you're thinking along the right lines, though. I mean, they wouldn't make this investment. They wouldn't look to spend close to $4 billion if they didn't think that they could sprinkle some pixie dust on Sophos and turn a company that's, reasonably valuable today into something even more valuable. So they're looking at that company and they're seeing an opportunity to do more than it's doing today, with some, assistance. And so the question is just, are they right? Cause it's a big bet.
It is a big bet, but I can tell you what the stockholders are thinking right now. And they're thinking wads and wads of cash are coming their way. They're thinking. I showed this briefly. I'm going to show it again. This is what they're thinking, Rich.
Yep.
Money.
Describe that image for the folks who are on audio.
For those who are on audio, that was two fists holding wads of raining cash.
And you know what? I hope this isn't inappropriate, but it did come to my mind. So you would remember, and some of our listeners will remember, a company called Reflection, right? Which is a security product very specifically for the MSP world. Sophos acquired them some years back. Along with the company came a guy named Scott Barlow, who we know, he's been to our events and so on. And he's really been the guy kind of spearheading the MSP partner program, and just everything MSP over there really is very much coming from Scott. And he did pop into my head when I read about this, because, you know, or anyone basically who agreed to, was part of the decision at Reflection to be acquired by Sophos. It's like, good move. this was good. And here's another example of why.
There's another one of why. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on what Tomo Bravo does with Sophos, as we are now watching a ton of these private equity companies as they're buying up all these different vendors and service MSP based protection companies and RMM platforms, stuff that MSPs are selling and getting recurring revenues on. Right. That seems to be the hot commodity for these private investment companies.
Absolutely right. And I'll just put this out there, take it with a grain of salt. There are rumors circulating, and you can kind of, you'll come across this online, but there are rumors about huge M&A kinds of deals involving vendors folks know about out there. I'm waiting to see if this is just the channel rumor mill, or if there really is something cooking with some very big names. But we'll know, one way or the other within the next few months.
Always exciting when there's movement in the big names. But there's also excitement in the small names too, Rich. And Vade Secure, not the largest name in the channel here, but a very good company, has a new email security solution that uses AI in an interesting way. Tell me about that.
Yeah, they have added a new, they call it their computer vision engine. And it's a new capability. They've just kind of woven it into all their products. They're not charging, it's not a separate system. They're not charging anybody for it. It's just really a new capability that all their software draws on right now. And essentially what it's designed to do is inspect images in emails in a much more sophisticated and effective way. So As security solutions generally have gotten better and better at detecting phishing attacks, the people who create phishing attacks, our good buddy, nefarious a-hole.
That guy again.
That guy, he's back. although he may be foiled here, I don't know. But what that guy has been doing, as these solutions have gotten better and better at detecting phishing attacks in text, is they're leaning more and more on images. They're using pictures. They're using logos. In some cases, it can be as simple, basically, as creating a JPEG of a normal email of text and putting that into the message instead of the text, because security solutions can struggle a little bit to detect a threat in an image. Now, there are other security solutions out there that have computer vision capabilities. What those tools do, according to Vade Secure, at least, what all those other solutions do essentially is kind of look at code behind the image and use that to create a kind of signature. And then they do pattern matching to detect that signature when they're inspecting an email. This, as folks are already thinking, I'm sure, in our audience, this is basically a blacklisting strategy, right? And we all know the problems with blacklisting these days. And this is why all these security vendors are getting into the behavior-based kinds of next-generation solutions, because it's really difficult to keep a blacklist up to date with all the threats. So there are other computer vision tools out there. They rely on the signature matching kind of approach. What Vade Secure has done is create an approach that utilizes artificial intelligence to actually inspect the image itself, to inspect the surface of the image, if you will, not what's behind it. And they say it's in a sense looking at these images the same way the human eye does, and it's looking for telltale evidence of manipulation and just danger signals that will tell them this is something that you should either be suspicious of or should just not click at all. So it's kind of an interesting technology in that respect. They've got it trained right now to, I want to see this number. I believe it's 66 logos right now that it can recognize. And it's from the most widely imitated brands on the internet right now in phishing attacks. So Netflix, Facebook, Bank of America, Microsoft, PayPal, and some others. They have trained this AI engine to recognize branding and logos from those companies. They've even gone to the trouble of training the tool to recognize sort of flawed versions of those logos, because sometimes apparently attackers will deliberately tweak an image in a way. You know, maybe they'll change the coloring just a little bit. You know, the blue and the Facebook logo will be off just a little bit in the hopes of throwing off a security tool. The Vade guys have trained their artificial intelligence engine to recognize messed up versions of these logos and different backgrounds and so on. But the idea basically is that it's not pattern matching. It's actually inspecting and thinking about artificially these images and warning you away from the dangerous ones. And those images, by the way, they're not just pictures. They're not just logos. They include QR codes, which is something that apparently is especially difficult to do.
Very, very interesting. Now that is cool. That is cool. I there's definitely something to be said about watching where those kinds of links go, but it's pretty smart to try to detect phishing attempts based on the images people see in an email. That's really, really cool.
And it's, you know, it's responding to the latest trend, essentially. My understanding is this particular technique, hacker technique, is only maybe 12, 18 months old. People have only recently kind of figured out the stuff I used to do isn't working so well anymore. So maybe I'll try graphics and maybe, you know, maybe that'll fool some of these systems. And so I'm sure there will be other people as well, other vendors as well, that invest some R&D energy in countering that hacker development.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how prevalent these phishing attacks are. In fact, like, I'll tell you a little funny story. So actually, just the other day, the helpful people at Apple Computer called me at my house to tell me that there was an issue with my iPhone account or something like that, my iPhone wow. account, and I need to be worried about it, and I needed to give them all kinds of information about me and my bank accounts, probably, to deal with this, which, Rich, no one was more surprised than me to find out that there was a problem with an iPhone that I don't own.
Yeah, well, that's problem number one.
Right? That was shocking.
I don't have an iPhone.
I don't even have one of those, and it's already screwed up, and there's a problem with it. That's amazing. No, so people, be diligent about this kind of stuff. And protect your. Now I'm a tech person. I get it, right? So I can see past that kind of stuff. Even when, you know, I'm sure you also got. I'm sure we all got like the calls from Microsoft. You know that there was a virus on my computer.
Yeah.
Or whatever, and people fall for that stuff. They absolutely do because they don't know any better. So products like this that can see attempts. To attempts from the nefarious a-hole to trick people and steal information or steal access or whatever. Anything you can do to arm your customers is good because they're going to eventually one will work and they'll fall for it.
Yep. Absolutely true. So, yeah, I mean, you know, end user training is, as so many people say, is an absolutely essential part of any security strategy now, but never going to be 100% effective.
Yeah. Now, they were talking about here about the image-based exploits, and there's lots of different kinds. I like the thought about the logos. What is the thing about sextortion? What is that?
I think that was, I'm looking this up now here in the article too. That was given to me basically as an example, an early example of this image-based kind of approach.
So if you're going to, set, and I can take a guess of what sextortion is, right?
Well, yeah.
And I can, and so I could see an email that says, we have naughty pictures of you. And we're going to put them on the internet unless you give a lot of money. Is that kind of a sextortion? Is that what
right,
it is?
Yeah.
So if they're going to add images to that, I mean, unless they actually have naughty images of you, how are they going to do that?
Well, I'm not super familiar with sextortion scams. I don't know if, doctored images are typically part of the, I mean, you know, they're threatening, presumably to release pictures. So, they might, doctor up some pictures or something like that.
That's a very targeted approach to do that though, right? Like, cause you would have to doctor up a picture of the person you're sending the email to.
Yeah. But these very targeted approaches are becoming, more common, now, approaches, like business, email compromise attacks, quite often we'll go after a very particular CEO at a particular company and somebody will spend some time to, research this person enough that, from their social media accounts, it's like, I know from this guy's Facebook account, which is open to the world, that he was just vacationing in Italy. And you can drop that fact into an email, a fake email that you send to the CFO shortly before asking to have all the social security numbers for the company sent, to you or whatever. And so yeah, these very targeted attacks actually are happening out there.
That's crazy. And so they'll like Photoshop an image of the CEO, like with an Italian street dancer.
I'm guessing that, is how, images would play into these attacks. Initially it was just, you got an email saying, hey, we've got embarrassing pictures of you.
So with that said though, how can their AI detect that? Right. Cause it seems like I can say you could detect inconsistency in logos. How do you detect Photoshop pictures of people, for example, doing the naughty dance in an AI algorithm? That it seems like it wouldn't work.
I don't know. It's a good question. If you give an AI engine enough time and processing horsepower to compare legitimate to doctored photographs, there are indicators that they can learn to spot that say this has been Photoshopped.
I suppose that could be the case. They can look for images with common alterations, but this extends into a more interesting topic about the future of this kind of stuff, because the doctoring images is an art form, and it's very, there are lots of people who can do it, but the new video-based doctoring, like the deep fake stuff.
Yeah.
You read about that? That seems like we're rapidly nearing a future where you just can't believe everything you see. And if that's the case, why would any CEO care if they receive something that says, oh, we're going to share these images of you to the world, when no one's going to believe that they're real anyway?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that kind of gets to the larger question of just in the world of deepfakes, do people believe everything they see, including the stuff that's totally doctored, or nothing that they see anymore? Because you never know what is or isn't real. I don't know.
Well, it's amazing. Some of the deepfake videos, if you go and watch some of them, like, it looks real. It really does.
Yeah.
And it's
and that technology is only getting better, right?
Right, and it's in its infancy,
yeah.
Right? So, like, generally, you I would say in the modern society, they're like, images. You kind of like, there's always that thing in the back of your head that may not be real, that might be doctored. But normally, you trust video, right? Because it's like, well, how can that? But now you can't even trust that.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, man. It's nuts. I don't know how AI is going to detect that, but AI can do a lot of cool stuff. So. Vade Secure, I hope your AI gets better and it protects people from the mean people of the world. Like Rich.
I'm already hatching evil schemes.
I got your sextortion email the other day with the doctored photos of Mr. Kitty.
Yeah, you got my phone call about the iPhone too. My one big mistake was forgetting you don't own an iPhone.
Right. See, had you said you are Android phone,
yeah,
I still probably wouldn't have believed you. But yeah, because hey, folks, spread the word. Microsoft, Apple, they will not call you if there is any kind of problem. They absolutely will never call you, right? Unless you like log and pay for a support ticket in advance. That is the only way you will ever talk to somebody from one of those companies, right? So they're not going to call you and say, oh, we noticed you have a virus on your computer. They're not. They don't monitor your computer for that stuff. They don't care. Yeah. Yeah. Funny stuff. All right. Let's move along here before we get into more examples of sextortion pictures, because this is a family show and we don't need to go into that level. Super Micro. Oh, you know what? It's always important to know what is going on with partner programs. So we try to always cover this stuff because it's these programs is how you get paid, and it's super important. So tell us what Super Micro has done to their partner program.
So they have updated their partner program in some interesting ways. You know, a lot of it, quite honestly, when you talk with them about it, isn't like new benefits, new qualifications, new tiers, all that. A lot of what they've done is take stuff that they've been doing in a somewhat informal way for years and put some structure around it at the request of their partners, basically. So I'll take a step back and point out, you know, Supermicro has been around, I think we say in the article here, I mean, more than a short while, 26 years. And they started out making components for system builders. These days, their business is mostly about selling complete manufactured systems, and in the server and storage space particularly. And they sort of differentiate themselves from the HPEs and the Dells and the Lenovos of the world in servers, and that they fill niche needs. They like to say that they're very good at customizing solutions to very specific use cases that maybe the big manufacturers don't support. So, you know, they've been around for a long time. They've had a partner program for a long time. They show up on our website pretty regularly. I don't think we've ever spoken about them on the podcast before, but they just recently updated their partner program. So one of the things that they did was, you know, they have been offering, obviously, partner education, like training materials, for a long while. But essentially, they just had this big library of training materials, and you kind of waded in there and figured out what it was that you wanted or needed to use. They have structured, they've organized that a little bit better now, so that you can kind of see if you're trying to increase your skills in this particular area. Well, this course here is the 101 level, and then you can move on to this one. That's 201. That one's 301. So they've created these kind of roadmaps for acquiring particular kinds of skills. They've organized all this material that they've created before, and added some new material to it as well. They have got an early access program at Supermicro, which is actually kind of an interesting just thing to know about if you're a system builder or just anyone really who relies on server hardware, endpoint hardware. Pretty much any time Intel or AMD comes out with some major new processor release, on the same day, I get a press release in my email from Supermicro announcing that they've got, you know, 15 SKUs or something like that ready to go using this new, you know, Cascade Lake or whatever chip from Intel. So they are very aggressive about keeping up with the latest stuff from the big names and actually having products ready to go early on. And if you're part of their early access program, you can be a part of that testing and experimentation and so on, and kind of build these tools into your solutions very early. So they've been offering partners entry to the early access program for a long time. They've just never really had defined rules for how you get in. It was this one-off kind of thing where somebody would contact their rep within the company and they would say, you know, I would love to get into your access program for this technology. How do I do it? And they would kind of figure it out together. So now they kind of have rules. I don't know the specifics about, you know, how that works, although I think it's fair to say that they are looking at what you plan to do with this technology and the potential market impact for them. But they have a defined process for getting in. They have rules around that. They, you know, similar sort of thing. They have these solution centers, you know, sort of like a lot of the distributors have, where you can do proof of concept work and so on. Again, available for a long time. Now it's much clearer for their partners what they have to do to apply for access and to actually get access. So that's kind of the story here, basically, is, you know, ease of doing business is sort of the label that people who manage partner programs will probably attach to this. They're, you know, Supermicro is looking to make it easier to do business with them by clarifying and defining how you take advantage of some of the resources they offer.
Well, so you could say that it's not very exciting when people are given rules. I don't like being given rules. Do you, Rich?
Well,
but I was going to also say that it's important to know how to play the game, right? Because if you don't know how to play the game, then everybody loses. So
you took the words right out of my mouth. That's the only the upside to there being rules where there weren't rules before is you can't win the game if you don't know the rules. So.
Right. So very good, Seth. I don't think we need to dive into this a whole lot. If you want to learn about a little bit more about this, we'll put a link to the article in the show notes. But we're going to move on away from news because we don't have any more news. But we're going to talk about the ASCII group and their what it says here, their 35-year balancing act.
Yeah, so we are right about at the correct time of year to be at you know, I don't know the exact day, but we are right at about the 35th birthday of the ASCII group. And, you know, I mean, obviously there have been other milestone birthdays in that organization's history. But we at Channel Pro felt like it was a good time to kind of take a step back and just sort of look at ASCII group, its role in the channel, and in particular, what it is about this organization that has enabled it to endure and remain relevant for 35 years. Because you just, you know, we all know how much change there is in this industry, how fast it happens. We can both, you know, Matt, name companies like big companies 15 years ago that don't exist anymore. The ASCII group is going strong at age 35. It's a pretty interesting and important accomplishment, I think, for any company in this industry to go that long. And so the question that we asked in this article here about their balancing act is, well, how have they pulled that off exactly? And this balancing act metaphor is sort of the thing that I came up with to explain it. They have carved out this place for themselves that is sort of it's a durable model and it's kind of unique. And so here's just a few dimensions of balance that they've achieved, and you can kind of begin to get a sense maybe for how this has played into their longevity, right? So one of these oppositions here is between collective power and autonomy. So fundamentally, what the ASCII group is about is lots of resellers and MSPs getting together, and through their kind of collective purchasing power, ASCII group can negotiate deals on their behalf with all sorts of different kinds of companies, providers of cyber insurance policies and accounting and legal services. They get, you know, ASCII group members get discounted rates with distributors because ASCII group can bring a lot of buyers to a distributor. So fundamentally, what they're about at ASCII Group is bringing lots of people together. And yet, at the same time, if you talk to ASCII Group members, what they love about the organization is, yeah, I'm part of this bigger group, and that means I have peers I can bounce ideas off of and get ideas from, and peers that I can actually go to market with. If I have a customer who has a satellite facility on the other side of the country, I can go to a fellow ASCII Group member and in a very clear and defined way that doesn't put me at risk of losing my client. I can farm that piece of work out. So it's a group. It functions as a group. You get a lot of the benefits of a group, but they don't tell you how to run your business, essentially. You still get to run your business however you choose to do it. And that's a little bit different from, so a lot of what I just talked about there, you can get if you join like an IT franchise organization, a TeamLogic IT, a CMIT, you know, they too have peer-to-peer advice and collective buying power and you know, best practices sharing and all that kind of stuff. But they also kind of have a formula, a recipe for how their franchises do business that, you know, they have tested and really believe to be effective. And for some people, actually, that is a great thing. I've written about TeamLogic IT in the not too distant past, and a lot of their franchise owners used to be attorneys or corporate executives. They decided they wanted to go into business for themselves, and IT looked like a promising opportunity. They really kind of need and want this guidebook that tells them how to launch or run a business, run a business. But the folks in the ASCII group really have figured that out or have their own ideas about that, and they don't want anyone telling them how to run the business. And so the ASCII group really does this very interesting job of allowing everybody to operate independently, but also allowing them to collect some of the benefits of collective action. The business model at the ASCII group is very much dependent on their relationships with vendors on the one hand, but also more critically, with the members. They're sort of in between. They're kind of balancing there. And it was striking talking to both the vendors and the members how delicately, how effectively the ASCII group does that. They are continually looking for new vendors to kind of bring into the fold that have something to offer that they think the members will benefit from. They give those vendors an opportunity to put their story out in front of the members, but they don't push the members to buy anything in particular. They're sort of a matchmaker in that sense. And they're adding value, apparently. You know, they're keeping the vendors happy and they're keeping the members happy. So there's a bit of a balancing act there. I could go on a little bit. Maybe it's taken them 35 years to kind of perfect this formula. But they have a model that is kind of hard to find elsewhere in the industry, and I really do think it is a key part for what it is that has kept them in business and like I said before, relevant for this long. It's kind of impressive.
You know, as you were talking there, I was thinking, and there is nothing like it, and the industry is very well served, and partners are very well served by being a part of ASCII. I believe for those who I've talked to that are ASCII members, they do get a lot out of it. But I was kind of thinking when you're talking about like, oh, members can, farm out work to another member and not worry about their account being stolen and learn about certain vendors. But right now they're not forced to use them. And I almost think like, is ASCII losing out? Or not, bear with me while I gather my thoughts. Mm-hmm. Could ASCII become another 20?
Very, very interesting question. Does the possibility exist that they could pivot a little bit and do that? You know, sure, theoretically. That is not the approach that they will ever take, I'm pretty confident. But there are similarities. So a lot of times I think when ASCII comes up, you'll often hear the phrase buying club attached to them, as if essentially, you know, what they do is help their members buy stuff more cheaply. And it was really interesting to me when I interviewed the top folks at ASCII for this article. They really wanted to make clear to me that they view themselves as playing a bigger, more strategic role than that in the lives of their members. They very much want to allow their members the autonomy to run their business the way they choose, but they see themselves as a resource that MSPs can draw on to essentially be bigger than they potentially can be on their own. And that's very much what the 20 is about. The 20, for folks who are listening or watching and don't know what we're talking about, is this kind of co-op for MSPs that has been around for a few years now. And so it's a bunch of independently owned MSPs that have gotten together, and they have pooled their purchasing power that's allowed them to get combined rates. But they also kind of do business in a lot of ways like one organization.
They operate as one organization in a sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that, you know, in a way they are sort of in between ASCII group and an IT franchise organization. And an IT franchise organization, I mean, your franchise is really owned by the franchise organization, and you're pretty tightly bound in terms of how you handle certain things. On the ASCII side, it's a much more entrepreneurial kind of approach where you're given pretty much unlimited flexibility to pick and choose what you want to do. In between a little bit is the 20, in that they have a tool set, not every tool that you use, but I mean the core tools, you know, comes from a shared tool set. Everybody's on the same RMM and PSA, for example. There are some things that you kind of need to do the way that everybody does it. But you're able to do that without selling your business, giving up your business, your brand, et cetera. But the ASCII group would very much tell you, I think, that they perform that same function that the 20 performs in terms of helping somebody who would otherwise be out on his or her own running a three-person company and competing with these much bigger MSPs, collect some of the benefits of being a much bigger organization.
Yeah, and do you think the staying power of ASCII is because of the value they provide from a buying side or from an educational resource side? Or is it kind of both?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of both, right? I mean, and really, when you talk to the members, they all are grateful for the price cuts and take advantage of that. But the thing that gets them really animated when they're talking is about all the peer-to-peer interaction. And, you know, there's a very actively used message board that they're all on. There are the events and conferences and online kinds of events that they do. The members are really in communication with one another on a pretty frequent basis. And that's the kind of thing that comes up a lot in these conversations in terms of what, you know, where the real benefit of being a member is. It's access to a lot of peers who you can exchange information with in a safe kind of environment.
Yeah, very cool. All right, well, anything else in here that you want to highlight about ASCII, or should we just let everyone go and read it for themselves?
I would say let's let folks go and read it. We'll have a link to it in on the show page, and you can go check out the story.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about a up-and-coming topic that we are discussing more and more and more, it seems, IoT, in particular the NIST security framework, is becoming the gold standard for IoT. Tell us about this article.
And we will not spend a whole bunch of time here. This is something that you're probably best served just kind of reading up on, but I did want to include it in the show just to kind of call attention to it, because I will bet there are a lot of folks who aren't even aware that this resource exists. So these days, most folks in the SMB channel are at least somewhat familiar with the NIST security framework. NIST is part of the federal government. They define standards in various ways. They came up with a cybersecurity framework that I don't want to quite call it the gold standard, but it is a very solid, respected standard for what the core elements of a complete security strategy look like. And there are a lot of solutions out there, a lot of vendors out there that have sort of embraced this approach in terms of how they approach the market. And a lot of people who advise MSPs and others to use that framework as a way to kind of structure their own security offerings. So NIST is already kind of a big name in security, but they have a framework now specifically for IoT security. And IoT security is just the wild, wild west, folks, right now. I mean, all sorts of different devices out there, new ones coming along all the time. The people who make these devices tend not these days to be terribly security conscious. You've got these default passwords that are going out with these tools and firmware that maybe hasn't been updated in years and so on. So there are a lot of problems with IoT security right now. And so it's just a, I think, a helpful thing for the entire industry to have the folks at NIST, the same folks who came up with the cybersecurity framework, come up with an IoT security framework as well. And it's still very, very new. It'll be interesting to see if this becomes as widely embraced as its predecessor. But anything that sort of, scopes the problem, defines the problem, puts a little a definition around the problem, I think is useful, because it is a big problem.
Yeah, now pardon me while I log into my my newfangled IoT device. Username admin, password 12345. Super secure, right?
Yeah. Where was it? Just within the last few days, and now I'm blanking on where it was. There was this I came across this real world example of some tool that had a default password that was 111111. And some hacker had used that to, you know, pull off some huge exploit. I can't remember what it was, but yeah, that you'd be amazed how often that kind of thing happens.
Yeah, it makes me think back to what's that one movie? Oh, Spaceballs. Remember the movie Spaceballs?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, where he's got it's the combination on his luggage. Remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
Oh, 12345. Oh, you should go back and watch that. It's pretty funny. Because that was also the password for something on their big ship. It's been a while since I've seen that movie, but Rick Moranis and what was the other guy? Oh shoot, Rich, what's his name? The comedy legend. The name is escaping me. He played President Scroob.
Oh.
Okay. All right, I'll look it up.
Yeah.
Mel Brooks.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was a Mel Brooks movie.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to think of who it was. Yeah. He played. He played the President Scrooge, but also the Schwartz guy, Yogurt. Oh, that's good. I got to go watch that. That was a good movie. Super duper funny. All right. Yeah, we're gonna put a link into the show notes to read up on the NIST framework for IoT. So if you're doing IoT, you'll definitely want to check that out. There's a lot of good information in there to kind of introduce you to what that is and where you can go and learn more about it. All right, we're definitely running a little long, and I apologize for that. But we are glad you stuck around because we have a great, great interview coming up with the CEO of Scout, Mr. Aidan Kehoe. We're going to talk about, Rich, why don't you tell them what we're going to be talking about?
Well, you know, and this has come up even in recent weeks here on the podcast. Obviously, security threats are nothing new, but security threats directed specifically at MSPs are a relatively new phenomenon, and one that more MSPs need to be kind of mindful of and dealing with. And that's what we're going to be talking about in this interview.
Hey, all right, welcome. We got a special interview segment this week. We're going to be talking with Aidan Kehoe from Scout Cybersecurity. He's the CEO of Scout. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the recent trends about MSPs and integrators and those who are selling managed services being actual targets, specific targets of like cybersecurity threats and the hackers and all that stuff out there, and how that's being a real problem for MSPs these days. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Aidan Kehoe. Aidan, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Matt.
That's good. I'm a little rusty on my interview introduction skills, apparently.
You're doing great.
So I would like to, I really appreciate you joining us this week. And for those who are not maybe familiar with you or familiar with Scout Cybersecurity, could you kind of give us a little brief rundown on what you guys do and who you guys are?
Yeah, sure. You know, I originally started the firm, about 5.5-6 years ago. Before this, I had a risk management background, had a risk management company. And, you know, my first kind of introduction to cybersecurity was when a client of ours had a data breach. And I, ever since then, got pretty enthralled with the space. And you know, we started the business for one core reason. And that's kind of remains true today, that there's a real shortage of talent in security. So even though there's a lot of money, a lot of people coming into it, the real shortage of expertise has been something that's getting, exacerbated across like the MSP sector. So the one thing that MSPs have that I think is only becoming more public today is they have always been on the front lines dealing with cyber problems. They may not have gotten the recognition that they were on the front line dealing with cyber problems. And now, as the problem's gotten worse, there's more and more focus and attention, you know, particularly with ransomware increases You know, I think for our business, we focused on monitoring and security as a service for MSPs and making sure that we could power them as they kind of look to retool their business to become security first. If you spent all your career building your business and servicing small businesses, now you have like all your customers asking you about cyber and cybersecurity. How do you get set up to deliver security as a service? So we built our whole architecture, our whole technology to power MSPs, and we're excited to bring in some people that have you know, worked at other companies focused on MSPs, and we went 100% channel from January of this year.
Wow, fantastic. So you actually kind of started as an MSP then and kind of evolved into this. So is that kind of how
we started in security, but we sold direct originally. I had a risk management background, but it was actually insurance was my original business, doing insurance and risk management. And I think, you know, but I've always worked with MSPs. So we've always had a lot of interaction with that industry. And I think, you know, one of the things that we noticed is, you know, look, a lot of businesses have more connectivity to third-party providers than even they realize. So if you're a small business and you're, you know, your IT provider, you know, is somebody that you don't necessarily deal with every day, but the days where you do deal with them is the day where you either have a problem or you're trying to get something fixed, you know. And I think the MSP community has done a really great job, you know, battling against a lot of these cyber problems without necessarily them getting the credit or the visibility that they need. So we kind of view the MSPs as like Batman. They're the heroes doing all the work, and we're more like Alfred in the background supporting them. So, and I think that's something that I think, you know, I'm hoping gets more visibility, more credit. The MSPs are the hero of this story. And I think, you know, we want to make sure that we're front and center with making that public.
Excellent. So Rich, we've talked a lot about this topic in the show recently. We've noticed that it's a trend, and I'm sure you've got tons of questions to ask Mr. Aiden here.
Yeah, you know, and I'll say when the opportunity to speak with you on this topic came up, I jumped at it because it is something that's just on our radar a lot here at Channel Pro lately. Mm-hmm. And I'll set this up basically by citing three sort of data points or references that just illustrate mm-hmm. the extent to which this is an important topic. So October 2018, almost to the day, a year ago, almost to the day, the Department of Homeland Security issues an alert. And I've got it right here. It's called Advanced Persistent Threat Activity Exploiting Managed Service Providers. Yeah. And so they're, you know, felt sufficiently concerned about attacks against MSPs that they felt they had to issue an alert. Last month, ProPublica, a journalism organization that's, you know, better known for writing about political issues and corruption and so on, they came out with an article about ransomware that specifically said cyber criminals are zeroing in on the managed service providers that handle computer systems for local governments and medical clinics. Another example of this topic sort of crossing over into the mainstream. And then just last week, actually, Continuum issued a press release about a new product that they have coming out. And sort of buried in there was a data point from a research study they have coming up soon that apparently is going to show that 74% of the MSPs they surveyed have experienced a security attack, at least one security attack at some point in the past. Now, we don't know if attack means breach or attempted breach or what, but 74% is a pretty big number either way. So from your perspective, in terms of what you're seeing as you work with MSPs, how widespread is this problem right now of MSPs being in the crosshairs from cyber attackers?
Yeah, so I think if you look at the statistics on small businesses and the challenges that they face, well, if small businesses are facing these challenges, inherently MSPs are going to be facing them at the same time because a lot of the businesses have, you know, hosting a lot of their key data with the MSP. I think what's changed in the last 12 months is that instead of the problem happening and it doesn't go reported, I think the problem's happening and it's getting recognized and reported because regulation is changing. So now if you have, whether it's you're in retail or you're in healthcare, you have regulatory requirements that you have to report certain issues happening to that specific regulator. So I think I don't think necessarily that the the volume of issues are going up at a much different rate. I think it's been consistently bad for a number of years, but I do think it's starting to get reported on a more regular basis. Going back to the first point you made about APTs and the DHS alert. So I think one of the challenges that MSPs face is it's very difficult to do attribution. So if you have an APT tool, it's used by a nation state, whether it's someone from China or Russia that's hacking the United States using those tools. Once those tools get, let's say, updated by DHS, they essentially become commercially available, and somebody in a university or somebody in a local town can take that same tool for around $50, $60 and use it to attack an MSP or a small business. So I think one of the big, big challenges that everybody's facing is attribution of attacks. So when you dig into that layer and you get underneath, you see that the same tools and techniques might be used that look like an APT attack. So, you know, again, why did we start our business? It's because there's a real shortage of security talent that can help you if you have a problem. So I think if you're an MSP and you're dealing with these issues and you have more and more threat advisories coming out from, you know, whether it's what Continuum released or whether it's what DHS released, or I think what do you do with that information and where do you turn? So I don't think it's necessarily that tools exclusively are the answer. I think MSPs need to continue to do the basics really, really well. And that starts to eat into their margin. They've got to do more work for the same amount of money. So unless MSPs are thinking about security as a business and a business model and how they're going to transition, like, you know, over 5 years ago, it was how do we move from break fix to recurring revenue? Now it's how do we take recurring revenue and get into security as a business? And so when you think of the shortage of talent and you combine that with the fact that there's not a lot of people who can communicate to end users as to why they should spend more money on security, all of these things together become a complicated challenge for MSPs to solve on their own. So we set ourselves up as a partner to kind of navigate this over the longer term. So we're not necessarily looking to have MSPs start with us, you know, straight away. So we have a small bundle that they can use, they can buy from us to protect themselves first. You know, it's like, you know, do you eat your own cooking? You know, so it's much easier for MSPs to recommend a solution to their small business customers if they're using it themselves. Secondly, I think a lot of these businesses that are regulated, they now buy, you know, if you're a small mid-sized business and your Fortune 1000 is your customer base, well, that whole supply chain is now starting to get audited. So you have to have certain standards and certain requirements that you're meeting every day from a security standpoint. And then you have to be able to prove that you're doing those things. So when you're a small business and a small MSP, I think it's difficult to do that on your own. So one is like, how do you process the news that's out there on the threat landscape? Two is, how do you manage your business model? And then three, where do you turn? If for one place to kind of help make that turnkey as a service. So I think these are challenges that MSPs are facing. I think you're seeing a lot more attendance at security shows and a lot more webinars getting attendance because I think people want to learn more. But I don't think the security community is doing as good a job as it could translating the threats and bits and bytes into what they should do today within the margin constraints that they have, in order to make this an opportunity for their business and help them grow. Does that make sense, Rich?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really interesting about that to me, you know, like I said, so this issue has come onto our radar at Channel Pro relatively recently. We've been talking about it on the podcast, but, you know, based on what you've seen, this has actually been going on for a long time. It's just we're seeing it more now. It's getting reported more now, which kind of raises the question in my mind. I mean, is this old, not old news exactly, but do MSPs in general, are they aware of the fact that they have been under attack for some time? And are they, you know, attempting to deal with it? Or is this an emerging issue that they're becoming aware of all of a sudden as well?
So I'll give you an example to help answer that question. If you talk to 20 MSPs and you said to them, have you ever suffered a cyber attack? I would say 90% of them would say no, 10% would say yes. Then as you talk to the 90% and you'd say, well, you haven't suffered a cyber attack, but have you experienced ransomware? Oh yeah, three of my customers had a ransomware attack. Have you ever had any issue with like business interruption because of something that came in and executed on the endpoint, or have you dealt with denial of service? They would answer yes to all those questions. So I think there's a difference between them believing that they've been attacked impact directly versus dealing with it as an issue that may affect their customers and in turn affected them. And I think slowly that's starting to change, where they're starting to see the connectivity of their own environment with that of their customers, and how those two are probably more connected than they might necessarily tie out in terms of how they think about risk for themselves. So I think on the 10% where they have direct problems, they generally, you know, view that as, okay, I had a cyber problem, it affected me directly and my customers, and I lost business because of it. So until they have a real revenue challenge associated with it, they don't necessarily view it as a problem that affects them directly. So, you know, the third component is size. So, you know, I think at the larger MSPs, they're not necessarily, the management teams aren't necessarily on the day-to-day of like what's happening at the account level, whether they're winning some deals or losing some deals. They don't necessarily know kind of how that thread gets pulled through from customer having an attack based on their enterprise or problem and flowing that through. The smaller MSPs, you know, it's much more visible to them around problem and revenue and kind of how those two things are connected together. I think more and more of the conversations we're having is they're trying to get to proactive solutions before they kind of have a problem themselves. But it's not obvious to them how they do it without having a cost challenge or a margin challenge day to day. So if you look at most MSPs, if they're in, let's say they have 10 to 100 customers, how do they think about allocating cost where they're already struggling to sell them, you know, IT as a service or security as a service for like, if they give it away, it may not, the customers may not want to put it in place because of the challenges that they have in implementation. They want their customers to have, you know, everything at it one click. No one wants to have the extra step, a two-factor, or, you know, the convenience challenges they're having with their own end users.
Yeah, well, I think the vast majority of MSPs are aware of the security threats that their customers are facing, and at least are attempting to do the right things to protect those customers. But I am curious, you know, like you were saying, your sense is if you were to ask a bunch of MSPs, maybe 10% of them would report having been attacked themselves, having their own infrastructure attacked. Those companies clearly are taking action to make sure that never happens again. But in general, in aggregate, as you look across the MSP population right now, are they doing enough, from your perspective, to protect themselves and their systems from attack, given that there is customer information in those systems?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. It's not even close. I mean, I think, you know, when I started this business, I initially started to speaking with customers. It reminds me of where MSPs are at today, where you're starting on that education curve and you're trying to have people understand the consequences of not taking action. But, you know, human behavior is the same regardless of how much you kind of want someone to make change. Change is difficult for people. So unless there's a compelling reason for somebody to do something, they're unlikely to do it. So I think on an intellectual level, I think MSPs are going, yeah, no, I know cyber is going to be a problem, but then, you know, I got to figure out how I, you know, get through my list for that day. And I don't think the shift is happening as quick as it's going to need to happen in order for them to capitalize on, one, the revenue opportunity that exists, and two, is, you know, the challenges that are going to face some of their customers. It's not something that's going to happen slowly. It's going to be something that happens quickly. So the ones who are proactive will really win. And I think it'll lead to consolidation in the market. I think it'll lead to a certain amount of MSPs going out of business and not expecting to. And I think it'll lead to a lot of challenges. But the short answer is no, they're not taking the actions necessary. And it goes back to the cobbler in the shoes, right? You know, I think they'd be quick to recommend things to some of their end users, but when it comes to themselves, I think it's more difficult for them to implement.
You know, Rich, I think a good solution to drive that message home for MSPs that they need to clean their own house and protect themselves is to just charge themselves a higher rate.
Matt, I can see that going forward. I can see that going viral.
I think Rich, it took a second for Rich to figure that one out.
Well, you know, it just, it, you know, like double clicking on your joke there, Matt. I mean, I think there's something to be said for that. I think, you know, if you can, if, you know, one of the things we're investing in heavily here is how do we make cyber simple, affordable, and accessible for MSPs themselves? Because if we can't do it for them, well, then we've got no shot of helping them do it for their customers. So we've actually started, you know, with a, we call it like a bite-sized bundle for MSPs to use just to kind of get started with a little test for themselves. I think what we're finding really interesting is, and this is something that we'll probably launch in January, is a service for the owner themselves in addition to that. You know, I don't know. I mean, I've got two children. You know, my son's 5 and my daughter's 3. And I've invested in identity protection for my wife and my kids. And it wasn't until I really started to see some of the alerts that were coming through on somebody. Like, I never thought my 5-year-old would have a problem. But then I remember, you know, his social security number's at a hospital. It's like in schools. It's all already out there. And that actually, I think that type of solution where you get to own it for yourself personally helps you apply at work, you know, some of the risk because you don't really think it's going to affect you, right? So I think there's this blended line between, you know, things that affect you personally and interpreting risk at work. So for MSPs, we're now trying to get them to test it so they understand the risk and only work from data that you get in real time. And everybody has a different risk profile, right? So some people are willing to take more than others. But one thing for certain is nobody wants to have a problem with their own stuff, you know? So if you can give them some visibility and some education, I think there's a way for that to really help.
Yeah, that's pretty smart too. It's really awkward having a conversation with your 5-year-old about why their credit history shows them buying a yacht.
Yeah, I know. I know. My 5-year-old in particular has, you know, is way ahead of his time in terms of investing.
That's awesome. So speaking of the bundle that you're talking about, so I know your current bundle is made up of a few different parts. There's an email protection part to it. There's security monitoring. There's a 24/7 SOC.
Yeah.
Endpoint protection. So what's this? Tell us a little bit more about the owner part of it, because that drives home right to what we're talking about here. This owner part that you're going to add later on.
So Matt, like you're in Chicago, right?
Yep.
So if you were to list off to me, what are the three things that you would want to protect most first yourself?
Me personally?
Well,
you know, your family, wife, kids, and home, we'll say.
Well, let's say data wise, what would you want to protect?
Oh, data wise. Well, as a person, I would say, you know, photographs, right?
Okay.
Financial documents, and my Steam library.
Yeah, right. So every single person, Matt, has between 3 and 5 things that they want to protect most first. So you didn't list out 20 things, but you'd probably struggle to name 10, but you get to 5 really easy. So what we do is we sit with the owner of every MSP and we ask them, hey, what's the 5 things that you want to protect most first? It's generally 1 or 2 things for them personally. They're like, I really care about my banking relationships. I really care about my customers' relationships, that nothing happens to them because it's the same thing. I really care about my email and I care about my phone because I took pictures and there videos on there that I'd rather not become public one day. And then we start from what they care about most and we work our way back. So the solutions that we recommend aren't just off the shelf. They're generally customized for each person based on the things they care about most and the risk tolerance they have. So for instance, if I say to somebody, look, if your regular email or your Slack was, you know, released on the internet, would that bother you? And they say, well, it wouldn't be good, but it's not the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world for me is if I have a problem with the disaster recovery and backup or with someone has ransomware, I can't respond quickly, or if this particular production environment goes down or this particular IP. So I think getting people, MSPs, they're really smart business people, and getting them to think about cyber risk focused on their business is probably that they know their business better than anyone. So if you start like the same way you and I just did there, Matt, it was like a small number of things that you cared about most first. And we start there, we work back, and it allows us then to focus our solutions, because our process is pretty similar. So 75-80% of it is the same out of the box. But all the value comes in your ability to customize that 20% for each individual person and their risk tolerance.
I wonder what Rich would protect.
Yeah, Rich, what about you?
Would you like it if your slacks were put on? Oh, no, you said slack, not slack.
Protect the iguana.
Yeah, you got to protect the iguana.
Yeah, it's important. So, question for you then, because you raised a really important issue earlier on in the conversation, which is that even some of the MSPs who are aware that this danger is out there may not be doing what they should be doing, partly because of the margin erosion.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for them in terms of thinking their way through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that's probably really important is they got to know their margin anyway. Like, I think there's a lot of challenges around truly figuring out what their actual costs are financially. And I think it's a struggle for a lot of small businesses to get really good financial advice to know what all your costs are. But let's assume that they did know what that looks like. I think focusing on less, you know, resell services and less point solutions, more thinking about security strategy for each of their customers and getting their customers to adopt the standard. So, for instance, what I would recommend to all MSPs, if they want to solve this problem and they want to get into this business, is pick a security standard like NIST, work on building out a solution that delivers a standard as a service, because as NIST evolves and as NIST changes, it presents more and more of an opportunity to get your underlying customers to comply. So it's, you know, it could take you 5 or 10 years, and then you can make some investments up front that allow you to capture margin and recurring revenue over the longer term. So that's one. Two is, and I admit this is a little self-serving, but you do have to have the right partner if you want to do this. So, and I don't care whether you use us or not, but spend the time to carefully choose a partner that's going to be with you for the long term. Because a lot of these relationships MSPs build, they've got, you know, 15, 20 year relationships with their customers. So you don't want to make a choice about something that's in the security stack and then that person's not going to be there 2-3 years from now. So making sure that the security partner you pick is not a one trick pony with just a product, but how do you make sure that that security partner can keep up with a landscape where there's massive investment coming in, there's massive change overnight, there's massive moves in the threat landscape, and there's a premium on speed. So I view those things very connected with margin. You know, margin and time is probably the two elements. How do you make sure something's profitable? And then how you make sure it's profitable over a long period of time?
You know, in terms of choosing partners, one of the issues that comes to mind is just making sure that the tools you're using are secure. Because that's part of protecting yourself and the customer data you have. So are there questions that you might advise an MSP to start asking vendors if they're really not inspecting vendors about the security of their products today?
No, not really. I think what's better for them is to just consider everything in test, verify, scale. So I think too quickly are people looking for an answer, oh, that's the product and sell it to all my customers. I think they should isolate a test, you know, if it's 10% of their customer base or 15% of their customer base, test a number of different solutions with 5-6 different customers and see what works best for you. So what works best for the MSP is not always the same. Some MSPs favor, you know, it multi-tenancy and the ability to roll out policy and integrations with RMMs. Others need more service. They need more handholding. That the technology might be there, but the handholding may not be there. Others prefer sales support, where you have all the sales support you need to kind of help roll this out across your customer base. But I think defining it as a test first and making sure you're clear about what you need and what success looks like for you as an MSP and before you move out across the portfolio, I think that has more value than asking them questions to test the vendor. Because frankly, you know, security is one of those areas that the best people in the world struggle with testing of products, and you need to have tremendous resources and tremendous development environments to do it in a fact-based way. most of it's like narrative driven, where someone says, oh, I have this product, I like it, you should try it too. So, and a lot of it's brand and marketing driven, which doesn't necessarily always tie out to the best product. The best marketing, the best product may not be the same thing. So I think for MSP, I think MSPs are unique. They're a little different than direct customers, where, you know, the consequences to their business are generally pretty tremendous if they make a mistake. And that's why I think testing makes a lot more sense than, because, you know, generally they're dealing with a person trying to market them a product. And, you know, it's like the wrong time to ask questions. The best thing they can do is test and see how they get on.
Yeah, testing with an end user customer seems to make sense, because that's how you're going to be using it in real life anyway.
Exactly. And then you get feedback, you know, you get feedback.
Yeah, and that's really important. So I think we're kind of running out of time, though. But Aiden, I want to give you a chance to tell people who want to learn a little bit more about Scout and the solution that you guys provide, where can they go to learn more?
Yeah, you can go to our website. So www.getscout.com, GETSKOUT.com. And I think, you know, reach out to us on the website. Pretty much all of our content is there, where phone numbers. And I think the main thing that I want people to know about us is, you know, we built the company to focus on great security and great service and bringing those two things together. So I think it's difficult to do great security. It's difficult to do great service. But we're working hard to do both for the MSP community. And we're excited to get to know more MSPs and help them get into this business.
That's awesome. And are you on the Twitters or the any of the social networks?
I'm not as many as I should. I think we are as a company, but I'm on LinkedIn.
So, okay, and what's your company Twitter?
What is our company Twitter? I actually don't know what it is. I should find out. By the way, we're going to have PR people who aren't happy with me right now.
I didn't mean to get you in trouble. But I tell you what, if you can't get it now, we'll look it up and we'll give it to everybody at the end of the show here, so they know how to reach you on all your social networks and websites and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But okay. Thank you, Aiden, very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I hope you had a good time talking with us. I know we got a lot. Yeah,
wasn't expecting the picture. I would have gotten a little more.
You look great. You look great. Yeah. It definitely doesn't. You don't look like you just got back from Pilates.
There you go.
I'll just say that.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we are back from our interview. Rich, that was a very, very interesting interview, I think. Do you have anything you want to say about it? I do want to thank Aiden Kehoe for coming on and doing an interview with us. It was great having him. It was compelling and interesting, and offered a lot of neat insight into this kind of security threats that are facing MSPs as being targets for these nefarious people, but also just on the security landscape in general.
Yeah, no, and it you know, it's just really interesting. Anytime you get an opportunity to talk about security with somebody who watches the market, but also kind of watches the security landscape from that perspective, it's an interesting and valuable thing. So yeah, very, very interesting chat with him. And you know, like I said earlier on, just couldn't be a more timely topic. We noted during the interview, you know, the federal government is concerned about this issue now of MSPs being under attack. It's happening more often. The reasons behind that are pretty obvious. And, you know, that the companies like ConnectWise and Datto and so on that sell tools to MSPs are very mindful of the issue and investing a lot of time and money in hardening their products. And MSPs, you know, need to be aware of this threat themselves and taking actions to protect themselves and by extension their customers.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important stuff. So if you do want to learn a little bit more about Scout Cybersecurity and Aiden Kehoe, well, all of the links that we talked about, we'll put link to Rich. I just cannot talk today. I got to tell you, my brain is like scrambled for some reason. We're going to put the links to the website in the show notes sheet. And we did get their social media account. Oh, Rich, what did they say that it was?
Gosh darn it, I don't recall.
Cici, we found out right after the show, and then I thought we made a note. Yes, @scout_cyber. @scout_cyber. So SKOUT_cyber. is where you'll find them on Twitter. See, Rich, I'm confused because we have two show note sheets for episode 121.
Oh, well, that's a problem.
One is way up at the top up there, and then one is all the way at the bottom. So that's why I was confused. But that's where it is. That's where you can find them. We'll also put put all that on the show notes and the description on YouTube for all you fine folks to find. All right. Well, that kind of wraps up what our main meat of the show and with the interview. But we do have a museum pick this week, Rich, and kind of a fun one. We're going way back. Okay. Are you ready?
Yeah.
So for those who might be new to the show, I have a gigantic collection of old technology. If it has microchips or a screen or takes electricity, I really have a hard time getting rid of it. And I've just amassed this stuff over the last 25 years. I've got desktops and cards and components and consumer electronic devices, all kinds of stuff. I call it a hobby. My wife calls it a disease. Either way, it's here for your benefit. And we like to pick one out and we'd like to talk about it week after week. So I've got a fun one. So Rich, I want you to think back in time to the time when computers, there wasn't really such thing as a computer monitor. Do you remember those days? What did the early computers hook up to?
Well,
particularly in homes.
All I can tell you, I mean, my very first computer was a Commodore VIC-20, and I hooked it up to a black and white TV.
A television, that is correct. A lot of the early computers hooked up to a TV. So back in those days, there were not a lot of TVs often did not have line level inputs. Right. So you might have had a computer that had like a yellow plug. That was pretty common in the old computers. Right. But your TV only took an antenna. So you needed to get a box in order to connect it. So I found this in the graveyard today, Rich, which I was down there digging around for what I was going to show off. And I found this, and I'm going to hold it up to the screen here. It might be backwards if I'm holding up to the screen. So apologize for that. But for those listening, it is a Archer video, and it says computer right on the box, video computer RF modulator, an RF modulator. Have you ever had to use one of these before, Rich?
Well, I'm waiting to hear. I'm wondering if that's a more powerful, sophisticated version of something that, because I did run into that issue. There was no input on the back of my ancient black and white TV to connect the VIC-20 to, and so it was I think plugged into like the antenna connector or something like that, and there was some little box back there with a switch that I had to move to go from video to computer and back.
And so it was probably something like this. Now yeah. This particular one, I will take it out of the box. This one has a pass through, I believe. No, it does not have a pass through. I was incorrect. So I'll take it out of the box. And what it's got here is, I'll hold up the back. So there's basically a video input, and this one has a 1,000 ohm and a 75 ohm selector on it for different types of line level inputs back in the day. And then there's an RF out. So you probably would have had something like this. If your computer had a line level output, you would have had something like this, some kind of box that maybe went into a little switch that switched the antenna feed from your main antenna to the feed from this box, because this would have modulated on channel 3 and 4. And sometimes depending on the kind of box you had, you wouldn't necessarily have to switch between the two. You would just feed this into that, and then channel 3 or 4, which is selectable on here, would have been your video for your computer. Most people from my age would be used to the Nintendo Entertainment System. A lot of people probably remember the little gray box that came with the NES that had an antenna input on the bottom and then a little RF lead to plug in the antenna. That was also an RF modulator. That's how it got the picture from the NES to a channel on your TV set. So this is kind of how it was done back in the day. Now, if you were to use this on a computer today, now this would have given you a very low resolution NTSC TV signal, which is actually at the time higher resolution than what most computers could output anyway, because most computers were text at the time or very, very low resolution graphics, 380 lines max. Today, this would be like if you plugged a computer, if you ran a computer at this type of resolution and into this box and into a TV with an input, with an antenna input, it would look like somebody smeared Vaseline all over the screen, and that's what you would be seeing. It would be awful. Right? It would look terrible.
Although, tempting to experiment. It would be interesting.
It would be. You know what's funny, though? I don't think I have... I finally did get rid of all of my CRT televisions. I don't have a single one left. So I have nothing that would have an antenna input in order to do that. But it would be really funny to take the scaled 2K output from a modern graphics card and try to run it scaled at NTSC resolutions. It would be illegible. It would look awful. I can say that. So for those of you who remember back in the days of using something like this to display your computer on your television, this was one of the things that you would have used to do it. The year on this, I'm trying to look for a year on this particular model. I mean, they still even sell probably RF modulators to this day, because another reason people used these a lot. I'm looking for a date. I don't see a date on it. They don't put dates on these. Old. I'm just going to say that old. Remember when DVD players first came out?
Yeah.
DVD players did not, they came out at a time when they were line level only. And a lot of TVs were not. A lot of, because like VCRs had RF outputs, they had like a built-in RF modulator in order to send the signal to the TV, but DVD players never had those. So it was a lot of people ended up having to buy RF modulators externally in order to hook up DVD players to televisions at the time. These days, all TVs and computer monitors are practically interchangeable these days.
Right.
Thanks to HDMI and all of the modern digital inputs, and since all TVs are gigantic LCD or OLED screens, you don't need anything like this anymore to hook up a computer to a television. And that wasn't always the case. Hooking up a computer to a TV was not always easy to do, even when HD TVs first came out. And a lot of people really did want to add or connect a television to a PC. A lot of graphics cards had like video outputs, like the yellow one, the composite output, but that was very low resolution. Some graphics cards had component video outputs, but those not all of them did. So it was always a lot of work to try to get those to work. And a lot, even if the graphics card had it, it wasn't always easy to use it, and you had to set the graphics card to certain settings. Now you just HDMI cable, plug it in, poof, right over to the TV set, and you got a beautiful high resolution picture. So that leaves me to move on to our tech pick, Rich.
Uh-huh.
So like I said, hooking up a computer to a TV is a very easy thing to do. And I like to play that was then, this is now, but you don't really need anything like this to connect a modern laptop or a PC to a television set. You just normally need like HDMI. So if your computer doesn't have HDMI, but it has like DisplayPort, you just need the right adapter. But my gosh, I mean, most things have HDMI on them now. So it's a little, I found something that it's a little bit different. And there is a need for something like this. So my tech pick is, I'm going to put it on the screen here for those watching, and I'm going to tell you what it is. This is the StarTech.com. Rich, I love a lot of, I love browsing the StarTech site because they have all kinds of just weird, wacky things.
Yeah.
I picked out their wireless HDMI extender, the ST121WHD2. So there it is right there. And this is something that I could absolutely see somebody having a need for in an office, at home, in all kinds of situations. Let's say you have a big TV that you want to use in a boardroom or in a living room, but the PC is located far away, right? And you need to get the picture from the PC over to the TV. Well, something like this is a wireless HDMI extender. You plug the HDMI output of your device into one side of that box, and then it wirelessly transmits the video signal over to the other one, and you plug the output into the television set, and poof. And now this particular one operates over 50 meters, so the television set, you don't have to run like a super long cable, right? Because you're not going to run a 150-foot cable. So this is a super easy way to do it. Now, you could totally see how this would be useful, like in a boardroom or something like that, if the TV's like really high or whatever, and you don't want to run cables all the way, you can just plug this in and poof. They also make some of these that are extremely long range. I've found some, StarTech has one that works up to 656 feet. Wow. I'm sure that's a line of sight. So as soon as you start throwing walls and other stuff in there, I'm sure it starts cutting that back. But that's a pretty good range. I've seen some cinematic models that work up to 1,000 meters line of sight. Now, those are really expensive. Cinegears make some like that. And generally, those are used on like production sets. So you have the camera guy, and it transmits it back over to various control stations and monitoring stations or whatever for the movie production set. But you could totally see how it could be useful. Anytime you have a device you want to get the signal a long way, something like that would be pretty useful.
No, I've never heard of this kind of thing before. And yeah, I could absolutely see how it would be useful. And I mean, you maybe had just kind of hinted at the answer to this question, but my first thought when you were describing it to me is, you know, is there any trade-off in terms of resolution, you know, image quality and so on, if you're going wireless versus wired? I mean, there are video production companies apparently who are, you know, transferring movies this way. So if you spend enough, apparently you don't have to make that sacrifice.
Yeah, this one is 1080p. So I imagine, you know, digital is digital. So if you can't run it for even a 4K TV, you're not going to run a 4K signal through this particular model. So it will output it at 1080p is what you'll want to set your display setting at. But that's high def. That looks really good. That's higher resolution than a lot of people's laptops even today. So supposedly there's no video quality hit using something like this. And I believe once you start really spending a lot of money, there's 4K capable ones. Like the Cinegears ones that I was telling you about, those are really expensive. Like this one, I think is like $350. Some of the ones that I was looking at are like $10,000-$15,000.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. So, crazy stuff. But for those who are in a situation where like, man, I got a long distance, I need to get a picture up on that screen over there or into that room from this room. And I can't run a cable or I can't do whatever. Something like this might just save your bacon.
Yeah. Cool stuff.
Yeah. And I will also point out, this is now the, I believe, third consecutive show I've managed to squeeze in the word bacon. So we're on a roll, Rich.
Everything's better with bacon.
Everything's better with bacon, including wireless HDMI extenders. So that is going to wrap up my tech pick. We'll put a link to that one in the show notes sheets in the show description if you want to check that out. And StarTech, they've got a couple other different models of this, variations with distances and stuff, some cheaper, some more expensive. So go and check those out. Rich, if you were going to tell us what happened, you usually are pretty correct on that when telling us what happened. And you are also usually pretty good at telling us what is going to happen, particularly when it comes to like new stories coming up and that kind of thing. So tell us, O Seer of Seers, what has been and what will be.
Well, you know, a great place to go if you want to know what has been is our In Case You Missed It post, which goes up on channelpronetwork.com every Friday. It is written by our own James Gaskin. This week, I can tell you, James will be writing about an interesting SMB storage solution from Commvault. More of an enterprise player. They've got this interesting new SMB storage tool that we didn't get a chance to write about during the week. You can learn a little bit about that in James's piece this Friday. He's got some information about new Azure IoT functionality from Microsoft. Zendesk has a new partner program. You can learn a little bit about that there. And then you can find out James's take on what happens when a car that some people refer to as a laptop on wheels really does begin to develop some of the problems of a laptop on wheels. We'll see what that's about this week. Looking ahead to next week, as I gaze into the crystal ball, I know that the ASCII group we were talking about before is going to be doing an event in the Boston area. D&H is going to be hosting their Southwest Technology Show in the Woodlands, Texas, which is near Houston. And then Mobile World Congress LA will be happening. Most folks, when they think Mobile World Congress, they think about the version of that event that happens every March in Barcelona. But there is a Los Angeles version of that as well that's taking place next week. And I'm already starting to hear some buzz about IoT-related announcements happening there from some relatively big companies. So we will be keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, the Barcelona one is usually where a lot of the big news happens, especially around cell phones and a lot of that kind of stuff. But the LA one is getting more and more of its own news, as I've seen over the years. So that's good that it's getting important. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. Now, you are going somewhere next week. Where are you off to?
No, actually, next week I am home. I think that is going to be the last full week I'm home until the week of Thanksgiving. But I am in Seattle next week.
Well, congratulations on being home for a week. I know that doesn't happen very often, but yeah. I know your travel schedule is coming up. In fact, we do have our own event coming up. The Channel Pro SMB Forum is coming up on November 6th. November 6th. Double check that for me while I talk. I believe November 6th. It's in the New York metropolitan area. It's actually Newark, New Jersey, DoubleTree Hilton Airport Hotel there, November 6th?
It is November 6th.
Excellent. We do have a pre-day event with the 20. If you're interested in checking that out, come along to that. But otherwise, definitely join us for the Channel Pro SMB4 main day event. Lots of great content, lots of great information. Also a good time, not a boring show, but you'll get a lot of it. It's a full day. It's a long day, but it's well worth it. You'll learn a lot and you get a lot of actionable stuff to go take back to your business and make it better and start making more money immediately. Go to events.channelpronetwork.com to learn more about it. Or you go to the main site, channelpronetwork.com, and just click on the events link in the nav bar there, and you'll go over there, learn about the show. That's where you can register. I believe it's $99 to reserve your seat. It's a free show. If you show up, the $99 is refunded to you. That's just to reserve your spot and to get all the materials and all that stuff ready for you. So you got to put a little skin up front just to make sure, you know, we're doing a lot for you. But you'll get it back as long as you show up and you sit down in your seat that you reserved. So definitely do that. It's gonna be a big show. And I hope we all get to see you there. Events.channelpronetwork.com. Well, Rich, if people wanted to follow us on the social networks, we are Channel Pro Network on Facebook. You can find our page there. We are at Channel Pro SMB on Twitter. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I am at Matt Whitlock. Rich, you are?
At Rich Free.
And of course, I want to give a special thanks to our interview guest this week, Scout Cybersecurity CEO Aidan Kehoe. I really appreciate you coming on and being a part of us, and hopefully we'll get you back to talk about other topics in that cybersecurity area in the future. Channelpronetwork.com is the website. If you would like to set that as your homepage, I highly recommend it. You'll get news stories and articles, great information, white papers coming out every hour of every day. So hit that homepage frequently and keep up with all of the content that we've got coming out. As far as Channel Pro Weekly is concerned, please subscribe. That's the easiest way to do it. You can do it on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, pretty much anywhere where podcasts are aggregated. You should be able to find us there. We're also, if you want to watch us, we're on YouTube. Go to the Channel Pro Network YouTube site. Links are in the show notes description and everywhere. You'll just type Channel Pro Weekly. You'll find us on YouTube. And if you're on YouTube, hit subscribe, and you got to hit the little bell thing. Otherwise, you don't actually get notified if we put new episodes out. So subscribe, hit the bell, and then you'll see all the shows that we have coming out. Rich, did I miss anything? That was a lot to go through.
I don't think so. I think you have given folks the information they need to keep in touch with us. Please, folks, keep in touch.
Yeah, it was all off the top of my head, too. You know, I think it'd be easier if I had them written out so I don't miss anything. I will give the email address the one more time. Podcast@channelpronetwork.com is the email. you got comments, you got questions, something you want us to talk about, a news story that you saw that you want to hear our take on, just really send us an email. It goes right to me and Rich. We will see it. We will read it. We will respond. We are here for you. And that's going to wrap up episode 121. Thank you all for listening and watching. We will see you all next week.